Good morning. Let's see. So my thought for today is to work on the algebraic structures that we have for integrals. And so let me just start with where we're headed in that regard, and then go back and just carefully prove each of the, or at least sketch the outlines of the proofs of all of the technical lemmas that go into what we're doing here. Okay, so the basic setup is going to be to look at these Riemann integrable functions on some interval, I don't know, 0, 1, a, b, whatever. So Riemann integrable functions, but in any case, on a closed interval like this. Okay, and we already saw that these contain the continuous functions, which we know something about, as well as increasing functions. And so there are some other functions as well, but it certainly includes those. And we have, whenever we have a Riemann integrable function, we can integrate it and get a real number. Okay. And so the structures that I'd like to show is that this is a real vector space. And this is a linear map. And it's actually a little bit better than just any old linear map. It's also monotone. So if I have a function that's bigger than another function, then this integral is also bigger. So this, it's also monotone. Okay, so these are the structures that I want to get today. And then on Wednesday, we'll get a few more, but these are the basic ones. All right, so to get there, I'd like to start with the lemmas that we've already used a bit involving the upper and lower estimates for the integrals. And so to that end, let me just recall the definitions over here for of these upper and lower estimates, and then we can start proving things about them. So recall that if we have a bounded function, and I'll probably go back and forth between using a, b, and 0, 1, but it, an enclosed interval works for everything I do. Then whenever we have a partition of a, b, then we had a couple of notions, in fact, I guess four of them. So one is the upper bound associated to that partition, right? And so that was just given by the sum I equals I one to n of the lengths of those intervals L sub I. And then we take for the upper one, the supremum over X in this interval I of F. And similarly, of course, for the lower estimate, you do exactly the same thing, except that instead of the supremum, you consider the infimum. So this we've already seen. Okay, and then we took the sup or inf of those things, and so the smallest sup or the biggest inf, so those would be the upper integral a to b f of x dx, or we also call it L for u for upper of f, and that was just the inf over all these partitions P of F of the U evaluated at F with partition P. And similarly, of course, the lower integral was just the L, and that was then the sup over P's of the L of F associated with P. So those were the definitions that we had. So that's what we want to work with. And let me just note what follows from this is that we can approximate the actual L and U by using P's. And let me just write out what we get. So one is that if we look at an L of F at a P, right, since L of F is the sup, this is less than or equal to L of F. But since it's actually the sup, it's also less than this L of F at P, at least plus some epsilon. Okay, and the quantifiers are this. This one is true for all P here, right? For every P, the L estimate of by P is smaller than the supremum of that. But this one is just true. Well, for every epsilon, I can choose a P, so this is true, right? So those are the quantifiers. So I can always sandwich my L between two of them. On the left, I can choose any old P, but on the right, I have to be careful and choose one that's fine enough that works for my epsilon, okay? All right, and similarly, of course, for the U. So U of F at P is always bigger than or equal to U at F. And but U of F is itself bigger than U of F at P. Whoops, it's a P. Minus this epsilon, and again, this is there exists a P for the second one. Okay, so that's just the basic definitions that we've been working with. Okay, so now let me recall the theorems that we have already been using and go back and prove now that we have some idea why we care. So the three basic theorems are 11.20, which is really the main one, and then it has two useful propositions that follow from it. And this one says that if I have a refinement, so P is a coarse partition and Q is a refinement of that. So these are both partitions. And I have a bounded function. Okay. Then I get two facts. So one of them is that if I look at the upper bound associated to F and P, that's not as good as what I get with Q. And so the Q one might well be smaller. Okay. And similarly, if I take a coarser lower bound, it's not as good and therefore might be smaller itself than the lower bound I get when I use a finer partition. Okay. So they get upper one goes down as I get a finer partition and the lower one goes up until they squeeze the actual value of the integral in between, okay? All right, and so let me, so we've used this before, but now that now I wanna go back and prove it. So this is the proof. Actually, I'm just gonna do a sketch here. Hopefully enough that it'll be clear how it works. And I'm just gonna look at part A because B is very similar. All right, and so the first thing to note is that if I'm gonna prove this, the partitions are finite, right? P and Q are both finite sets. And so I might as well just add one point at a time, okay? So I might as well just assume that Q has got one extra point in it, and then I could do it again and again and keep getting my bound. So, so might as well assume. That Q just has one point more than P. Okay, so we have our partition P, and there's just one more point here in this Q here, right? So Q has that one extra point. Okay, and but then the point is that most of those intervals are the same. This one's the same in P and Q, this one's the same in Q. Only one interval gets subdivided, and so I might as well assume that that's everything, okay? So let me also assume that. Since only one interval changes, one interval of P is subdivided by Q, I I can assume that P is just I just got 2 points, z and x and z, and Q has just 3 points, x, y, and z. Okay, so I've got just added one more point, and so I just have just focused on this piece here where I have x and z, and then that red y there. Okay. Okay, well, so let me just draw a picture and complete this proof. So first, let me just draw the picture over here. So give myself a little bit more space. So if I have my function and I have my 3 points here, x, y, and z, then when I look at the upper bound, which is what I'm looking at, if I look at the partition X, I get that whole box. Whereas if I look at the partition, the partition P, if I look at the partition Q, so that involves also this Y, then I have this box and this box. And so the difference is right here. Okay, so when I look at the Q, it gets a little bit smaller. All right, so that's the picture. Let me just write that out formally now. So computing. Okay, so let me just write out what the Q estimate is. So U F Q. Okay, so that's gonna be the, it's got two rectangles here, and one of them has the L being Y minus X. And then the height is the sup over alpha in, well, it's in that first interval, so it's between x and y of f of alpha, okay? And then there's a second rectangle, and that rectangle has width z minus y, okay? And it has a height, the sup, over beta, but this time it's not in x, y, but in z, y, the second interval there, of f of beta. Okay, any questions about that? So that's exactly a reading off the definition, I guess. Let's see, I have it up here. The definition here of what this upper thing is, right? I have the sum, there are just two pieces here. I have the L's and they're the two sups, right? So that's the definition. Okay, and so now I want this, however, to be less than or equal to something. And all I'm gonna do is change over what I'm taking the sup. So instead of looking at the sup over just say this little interval, I'm gonna look at the sup over the bigger interval. Of course, I'm allowing more values, so it might get bigger. All right, so that's why I have to have a less than or equal here, and that's all that's gonna change. So everything else is gonna stay the same, just copying exactly the same, y minus L, x, sup, alpha runs from x to, okay, but this is the one place where it changes. I'm gonna go all the way up to z. Otherwise, everything is exactly the same. And then I again have the, oops, that's an oops, element. And then I have the sup of, oops, already wrote sup, sorry. The value of my function f evaluated at alpha, right? And so then the second one is exactly the same again, except that once again, I'm going to expand the range that beta is allowed to explore. And this time it's the left-hand side, I'm gonna change also to x. And everything else is identical to what was written up above. So x to z, f of beta, okay? All right, and but now these are the same, right? So this is then just equal to the sum of this, z minus y plus y minus x. So that's just gonna be z minus x. And then these are the same sup there. So this is by definition, u of f with partition p. And we're done. Okay, any questions about that? So that's the sort of heart of all of our technical proofs. All right. Okay, so then let's get the two propositions that follow from that theorem that we've been making use of that are very handy. And so first of all, proposition 11.21. Okay, and now it says that if we take any two partitions, no requirement that one be a subdivision of the other, just any old partitions. So if P and Q are partitions of AB, right, and we have a function f, which is bounded. Okay, then we want to say that the lower estimate of f associated with p is less than or equal to the upper estimate of f associated with a different partition q. Of course, if it were the same partition, that would be pretty clear. Because if we go back over here to the definitions, the only difference if we kept the same partition is that we go from a soup to an inf. And of course, the soup is always bigger than the inf. So that would be clear if they were the same. But here we're actually going to prove it now for two possibly different partitions, P and Q. Okay, so that's why that's a useful fact. But it's pretty short now that we have this other theorem. So proof. Okay, so let's just start. So we are going to take a U of f, L of fp, I guess is the one that we wanted here. L of fp. Okay, but this is less than or equal to, all right, well, if I go over here to my theorem, theorem 11.20, well, as long as I refine it, then I get something that's got a bigger value. So I just have to get something that's refined. That refines it. So I'm going to take a L of F and I'm going to take P union Q. Okay, so this is clearly something that is bigger. All right, so it's a refinement. It's got more little bits in it, so it chops it up more finely. And this is just a theorem 11.20 here that gives us that inequality. Okay, but now just from the definition, we have that that's less than or equal to U of F with the same partition, P union Q. But then we go back on this, I guess, was 11.20 part B. And now we can use 11.20 part A. And that one says that if I have this refined one, it's smaller than what I get when I take a coarser one. And so this is then less than or equal to a U, F, Q, and the proof is done. Okay, any questions about that one? All right, so then the final and most useful one. Drops any reference to the partition, which is 11.22. And it says that our L, this lower integral here, is always less than or equal to our U, okay? Which is a useful fact. And so if we have a bounded function then the L of f is less than or equal to the U of f. Okay, and remember, of course, as written over here, that L of f is just the soup of these LPs and the U of f is the int of the UP. So this is gonna follow from the previous proposition. All right, so let's make it do that. So proof. All right, so for contradiction, let's assume that it's false and get a contradiction. So assume for contradiction that we have the other thing. And so that would mean that L of F is bigger. And let's say it's actually equal to U of F plus something, that makes it bigger. And let me call that something 2 epsilon just because it's handy to have it that name. So epsilon is greater than 0. All right. So this is what would happen, right? If L were bigger than U, then there would be some difference and that would be positive. So I'm going to give it a name, which is 2 epsilon. Okay. But now I'm going to make use of these estimates that we have over here. Okay. Relating L to one partition and U to another partition. So then, so we have L. Well, let me write out my formulas carefully here. So there exists P and Q with, so I have this L of F. Well, if I look over here, it's less than or equal to L plus epsilon. Actually, strictly less than L of FP plus epsilon. And if I look over here, I have that UF is greater than UFP minus epsilon. And these are typically going to be different. So this is greater than UFQ minus epsilon, right? So I know there's some P and some Q, so I get this. Okay, and so then we combine. All right, and we have that L of F is less than, just copying what I have up above, L of F P plus epsilon. Okay, so that's what I just wrote. But this is then less than, and so now I wanna make use of my previous proposition here. And so this proposition says that I can take two separate partitions and I get that the L is less than the U. So let me do that. So this is less than or equal to U, what did I do wrong here? I put my parenthesis in the wrong spot. Let me fix my parenthesis. Parenthesis plus epsilon, right? Okay, and so then using 11.21, I get that that's less than or equal to U of F, and then I can put in any partition I like, and so I'm gonna use the Q partition. Okay. All right, but then I can use this other fact. So this one is follows from here, and this one follows from here. All right, and so that says that that's less than U of F plus two epsilon. Okay. All right, I get one epsilon from here and one epsilon from here. So that's my two epsilons. And then this is equal to, L of F by hypothesis. Okay. This is a contradiction. Right, so I have L of F less than L of F. Okay, so any questions about that? So that's the last of our three technical and helpful lemmas about these U and L, upper and lower estimates for our integrals. Okay, so then the goal is to, as advertised here, get these facts about my my space R int and the map to R. So that this is a vector space and this is a linear map, which is monotone. And I want to make use of these lemmas that we've just proven, 22 and 20 mostly, these two, to prove those things. So let's start proving them. Okay, so to show that I have a vector space, do people remember what I need to do? There are two things I need, right? So I need, whenever I have a constant, which is a real constant, so it's a real vector space, and some element of my space, F is in Rint, we have C times F is also in Rint. And the other thing that we'll need is that whenever I have two elements, R, F, and G in R int, then we have that their sum is in R int. Right, so that's what we need. And to show that the integral is linear, okay, so then we need that the two related facts that for all C in R and F in R int, this time we have that the integral itself of C times F is equal to C times the integral of F, right? That's what we need. And for the pair, we need not only is it integrable, but the integral is the nicest possible thing. The integral of the sum is the sum of the integrals. Okay, so those are the things we need. So any questions with that? That's our goal, is to prove those things. Okay, so let's start. So the first two are gonna come from, let's see, I guess it's 11.32 in the text. Okay, and it says the first two facts, this one and this one. All right, whenever we have C in the reals and F in the Riemann integrable functions, maybe I'll write it on AB. I don't see any reason not to do all in general AB. Then we have CF is in the Riemann integrable functions with the integral from a to b of c of f of x dx equal to the integral from a to, oops, got too cramped in there, equal to c times the integral from a to b of f of x dx. Okay, so we have the two first steps to proving those two things. Okay, so let's prove that. So proof, all right, I'm gonna do a special case where C is positive, and think about what happens if C is negative, all right? So something a little bit changes, not a huge amount, but it's something. And so think through what is gonna be different as I go along here if C were not positive, but negative, all right? So think that through. All right, so, right, so recall that the definition of this of being integrable was that the upper integral and the lower integral agreed. So I have to compute those and show that they're the same, and then I'll be done, right? So let's compute. All right, so let me start with the upper one. The lower one will be similar. So I'm going to compute the upper integral from a to b of c times f of x dx. Okay, so let me just try that. So first of all, I just remember the definition. So this is, of course, by definition u of cf. Okay, and that is by definition the int over p of the sup. I'm sorry, the sum, I runs from one to n of the lengths times the sup of the values x in the interval I of f of x. Oops, lost my c, c times f of x. Right, that's just copying out the definition. That's the definition of the upper integral. Okay, but now what happens? So if what is the sup of a constant times a function? So if I just multiply my function by something, what happens to the sup? Is that clear? So if I multiply my function by five, the sup is just five times as big, right? It happens at the same place. So this constant here, I can just move outside there, right? Okay. All right, but that's just a constant, and it's the same constant everywhere in my sum. So I can just move it outside there, right? So it's the, instead of the sum of five times terms, it's five times the sum of the terms, right? So I can move it outside there. All right, but then I'm taking the int, the int over five times something is also five times the int, so I can move it out there, right? So I can just drop my c all the way outside, and it's still true, all right? So this is then equal to c times. And then everything is exactly the same, except now my C has gone from the inside. The inf over P of the sum, I equals one to N, little L sub I, sup X in interval I, and this time without the C, so F of X. Okay, but by definition, everything except that C is the upper integral for F. So this is equal to C times the upper integral for f of x dx, okay, which is what we wanted. All right, and so that similarly, I could do the lower integral, a to b of c times f of x dx, and I'll get c times the lower integral, a to b of, let me not write it out, but it's, very similar. Actually, does everyone see what'll be different when I do this? If I do this lower one as opposed to this upper one? So as I go along, right, this will become an L, and this will become a sup, this will become an int. So just the sups and the ints change, okay? But you'll end up with the same thing. Okay, but F is itself Riemann integrable, right? That was our hypothesis up here, right? Is that F is a Riemann integrable. So this one and this one are the same, okay? And so then when I multiply them by C, they're still the same. So, but F is a Riemann integrable. So we have that the upper integral of F is equal to the lower integral of f. So we're done. So the upper integral of c times f of x dx is equal to c times the integral of f is equal to the lower integral of c times f of x dx, and in particular, that means that CF is integrable because they're the same. And as we wanted, the integral of C times F is equal to C times the integral of F. So we're done. Okay, any questions about that? Did anyone see what happens if I took a negative C? So note what about, consider C less than zero. So what would be different? So if I go through this computation, can anyone see what's not, doesn't quite work if I had a negative C? So I had a function that looked like this, and then I multiplied it by a negative number. So I got something like that. You want to see that? So it's right here. If I take the sup, right, of a negative, that doesn't give me the sup here. It gives me the inf. So it switches from sup to inf. Okay. Anyway, you should try it. You get that this upper integral of a CF is equal to C times the lower integral of F. Okay, so it still works. Anyway, you should try it yourself. Okay, so any questions about that one? So that's the first two pieces here of showing that our function, that our space is a linear, a vector space, and our function is a linear map. Okay. So what's next is this second part. We want to show that when we add them, we still get a integrable function. So the upper and lower integrals are still the same. And in fact, we get a specific value, right? Which is the sum of the integrals. All right, so let's try that one. So this is 11.33 in the text. All right, and it's similar. So let's say that we have two Riemann integrable functions. All right, then we want two things. So first of all, the sum should be a Riemann integrable. And furthermore, the integral should be what we want it to be. So the integral a to b, f of x plus g of x, dx, is going to be the sum of the integrals. Sum integral of f of x dx and g of x dx. Something that we know from Math 21 is true for nice enough functions, and this is showing it for all of the Riemann integrable functions. Okay, so let's do that. So proof. All right, so once again, let's just try computing the upper integral and the lower integral and see if they're the same. That's what we mean for it to be Riemann integrable. All right, so let's begin. So compute. All right, so let's start with the upper integral, just like before, a to b, and we're looking at this f of x plus g of x dx, all right, and we want to get what it is. So first of all, we can just look at the definition, just like we did before, right? So we should be getting pretty fast at this by now, right? So we have this definition, so it's the u, and so it's this definition. So let me just write that out again. So this is going to be this just copying what I have here, the inf over p of the sum I equals 1 to n of the length of my interval times the sup x in the interval I sub I. And whatever we're taking the sup of now is whatever it is we had. Instead of c times f this time, it's going to be f plus g. Okay, just the definition. All right, but now what happens if I, instead of looking at the sup of the sum, how does the sup of a sum of functions compare to the sum of the sups? Does anyone know that? So does that make sense? So I have these two functions, f and g, and I want to look at their sum, f plus g, and I want to look at the supremum value of that sum and compare that. Yeah, exactly. I see it here in the chat. That's exactly correct. The sum of the sups could be bigger than the sup of the sum, right? So the sup of the sum is less than or equal to the sum of the sups as written there in the text, right? Because the sup might happen at different places like they do here, right? So if I add those two, that's going to be bigger than the actual sup. So let me just write that out, just as written there in the chat. So this is then less than or equal to, so that's the key. And everything is the same except, so I'm gonna leave the int over p, I'm gonna leave the sum over I from one to n, I'm gonna leave the lengths li, but now I'm gonna replace the sup of the sum with the sum of the sups. So the sup of x in I of f of x plus the sup. And actually, just to make it clear that the two values might be different, the place I'm putting it, let me rename it. I'm going to call it y, just to make it clear that the x and the y could be different spots where my function f and my function g take their maxima. Okay. Okay, great. But now we're home free because now we can just do this one and we can do this one, right? And those are the two sums we're looking for. So let me just write that out. So then this is just equal to the inf over p of the sum I equals 1 to n of the li sup over x in ii of fx plus inf over p the sum I equals 1 to n the of li times the sup of g of y, I guess it is. Y in I, and actually, all right. Okay, and so this is exactly the two integrals that I wanted. So this is the upper integral of f. And this is the upper integral of g. Okay, those are the two things that we wanted. Okay, and now once again, we can use the fact that f and g are integrable. And so those are just the integrals. Actually, let me do the lower one first. So similarly, and I'll just do it in the same order that I did before. So what did I do over here? Here first I computed the upper integral and got it to be what I wanted. Then I computed the lower integral. And then I said, okay, now since these are integrable, these are all equal to the actual integrals. And that's what I'm gonna do again. So let me just copy. So similarly, the lower integral from a to b of this sum of functions is, well, in this case, it's going to be bigger than or equal to, right? Because it'll be the inf of the sum, which is bigger than or equal to the sum of the inf. The lower integral from a to b of f plus the lower integral a to b of g. Okay. All right. But we have that f and g are integrable. So those are the same, right? These are upper integral over here. This one and this one are equal because these are integrable. Okay. So the upper and lower integrals for f are the same, the upper and lower integrals for a g are the same. So we have, that the upper integral u of f plus g is less than or equal to the integral from a to b of f of x dx plus the integral from a to b of g of y dy, which is less than or equal to l of f plus g, right? Maybe I should note that up here. So this is, of course, by definition, equal to u of f plus g. And this one, by definition, is equal to l of f plus g. Okay, and I just use the u and the l notation here. Okay, so this is, by our previous theorem, this is, less than or equal to u of f plus g. And that's what we just did some work to prove. This was theorem 11.22, proposition 11.22, okay? Okay, but now we have the same thing at the two ends. And so all these inequalities are equalities and we're done, okay? The inequalities are equalities. Okay, and so u of f plus g is equal to l of f plus g. F plus g is integrable. And then finally, we just computed the integral. With the integral of f plus g equal to integral of f plus the integral of g. Okay, so we completed our proof. That completes the original assertion here that my functions integral is a linear function on this vector space. Okay, so let's see. Unfortunately, just scroll briefly. I'll scroll it right back in a second. But my initial claim was that I had a linear vector space done, and that we had this linear map done. So the only thing left is to prove that it's monotone. Okay. So that's the last thing. Let me put the proof back. Sorry for scrolling it off. And now let me prove the monotonicity, and then we'll be done. So the last thing for today. And actually, we get a stronger statement. Not only is the integral monotone, but the U and the L are themselves already monotone. So let me prove that. So this is a theorem or proposition. Let me see. I think it's a theorem. 11.39. Okay, and what that says is that if we have a bounded function, so it's not just Riemann integrable, but this is for any bounded function. Okay, two of them. G and F are both bounded functions, and F is less than G pointwise. Okay, then we have the inequalities of their integrals. And actually, as I said, we actually get the upper and lower ones, so we write both of them. So A, the upper integral from A to B of F, is less than or equal to the upper integral from A to B of G. And similarly, it's also true for the lower integrals. Okay, and as a corollary, if they're integrable, then of course that's also true for the integral. So let me just prove this. Let me just prove B is similar. Okay, so let's just write out the proof. Let's just compute. And by now it should be pretty familiar because this is the same computation that we've done before. I want to take the integral from A to B and the upper integral of f of x dx. And by definition, that's our u, and that's the nth overall partitions p of the sum, same as always, 1 to n of the length times the sup over x in the interval I sub I of the function f of x, right? That's the definition. Okay, but if my function g is pointwise bigger than f, well, so is it sup. Okay, so we're, you know, if we have this f here down here and g up there, well, the sup of g is going to be bigger than the sup of f. All right, and so this is then less than or equal to exactly what we wanted. So leaving everything the same, int over p, sum I equals 1 to n, little l is the same, sup is the same over x in ii. The only thing that changes here is that we're now looking at g. And otherwise, everything is identical, okay? Which is what we wanted. So this is equal to the upper integral for g. And the proof is done. Okay. All right, so we succeeded. So we got that our space, our new space of functions that we started with last week, this Riemann integral ones, is a nice vector space. And we have this map here as a linear map, and it's got this extra monotone structure. And on Wednesday, we'll start to see how this gives us a nice new notion of convergence, a different norm. Okay, out of time, and I will turn off the recording and stick around for questions.